And then thirdly, we come to craving. In a sense, it's the poison par excellence. It's not just desire. It's what we may describe as neurotic desire. Take, for instance, the case of food. Not being philosophical, it's ordinary food. We all have a desire for this. We all like to eat food. We all have a good, healthy appetite, or at least I hope we have. And this is quite normal, and this is quite healthy. But the desire for food becomes neurotic when we try to use food as a substitute satisfaction for some other need, usually either mental or emotional. Only last night I was reading a magazine, and in this magazine it said that there was a report by a writer for young girls' magazines. Not the sort of thing one usually takes an interest in, but this was rather interesting. And this particular writer for these young girls' magazines, I've never seen any of them, but perhaps you know what it meant, wrote that many girls, readers of these young girls' magazines, wrote in to say to aunt or uncle, whoever it was, I don't know, that when faced by emotional problems, what they were you can probably imagine, they felt an uncontrollable urge to eat sweets and chocolates. Now, this is a neurotic desire. In other words, it's a craving. Now, craving can be eradicated by various practices. And as we can see only too easily, craving is quite a problem, especially in modern times. There's a whole vast industry geared to the stimulation of our craving and nothing else. And what is this? This is, of course, the industry, or whatever you like to call it, of advertising. It's geared to convincing us or persuading us, with or without our knowledge, that we must have this, that, or the other. In fact, we may say that advertising is one of the most immoral of all the professions. I'll mention just a few of the practices which are designed to eradicate craving. You can see how big the problem is from the number of the antidotes. Some of the antidotes, I must warn you in advance, are really quite drastic. For instance, we come first of all to a contemplation of the 10 stages of the decomposition of a corpse. This is quite a popular practice still in some Buddhist countries. And this is said to be especially good as an antidote for sexual craving, in other words, for neurotic sexual desire. I won't describe these stages of the practice one by one. That might be a little too much for some of you. But if one can't go the whole hog, as it were, there's a simple version of this, a milder version, if you like, and that is simply going and meditating in a cremation ground, a place where dead bodies are burned. In India, as you probably know, they don't usually bury, they usually cremate. And a special area, a special ground, is set aside for this purpose. It's called a cremation ground or a burning ground. And very often, it's on the banks of a river. So one is advised to go along there at night alone and to sit and meditate, preferably when it's dark. And I can assure you that these cremation grounds are not always very pretty places, at least by day. You get fragments of charred bone and so on, charred cloth lying about, and usually there is quite a stench of burning human flesh still lingering in the air. But it can be a very beneficial and interesting and even, I would say, exhilarating practice. I remember that I had one experience of this myself in India many, many years ago on the banks of the river Ganges, not very far from Lucknow. I remember there was a beautiful stretch of silver sand along by the side of the river Ganges, and that was used as a cremation ground. And on this particular night, I remember, it was the night of the full moon. So the whole thing was completely silvered over. And one could just make out these slight mounds here and there on the sand where cremations had been held. And there were little bits of bone and pieces of skull And I remember it was very quiet and very, very peaceful. And one really felt quite away from the world. And there was nothing depressing about the experience at all. One can only say that it was exhilarating. One felt, as I say, away from it, or one felt as though, almost, one's own cremation had already taken place. It does occur to me, since we're on the subject, that it's a very interesting ceremony, that when a Hindu becomes an Orthodox sannyasin, he performs his own funeral service. He, as it were, goes through the motions of cremating himself. Because the idea is that when he becomes a sannyasin, when he gives up the world, he is dead civilly. He no longer exists so far as the world is concerned. He has died, he's dead and gone. So the last thing he does before going off in his yellow robe is to perform, to conduct his own funeral ceremony. And then he goes away. It's the same sort of idea. This association of death, as it were, with renunciation and eradication of all worldly cravings. Now, if even this is too much, if even this occasional visit to the cremation ground or the graveyard is too much, it may be too much for quite a lot of people, then if one wants a still milder form of the same sort of practice, one can meditate simply on death. Meditate on death. That death is inevitable, it comes to everybody in due course, none can escape it. So since it must come, why not make the best possible use of one's life? Why devote one's life to unworthy ends? Why indulge in miserable cravings which don't bring any satisfaction and happiness in the long run? So in this way one meditates upon or reflects upon or dwells upon the idea of death. And this is an antidote, we may say, for craving in general. Whether it's a craving for possessions and goods or success or pleasure and so on. One can also meditate upon impermanence, thinking that everything is impermanent, that nothing lasts, that nothing stays, whether it's the solar system or whether it's your own breath from instant to instant. Everything is changing, everything is flowing, everything is impermanent, everything is transient. So this has the same sort of general effect. When one remembers that everything is going to pass away, it's just like the clouds passing through the sky. But one can't hang on very determinedly to things when one knows that sooner or later one's going to have to give them up anyway. Now, there's another kind of practice, and this consists in what is known as the contemplation of the loathsomeness of food. Now, I'm not going into the details of this practice either, because they're rather unpleasant, quite deliberately so. But this practice, we may say, is very good for young ladies neurotically addicted to sweets and chocolates. Now, under this particular heading, one should select the exercise according to one's needs. If one feels that craving is very, very strong and very powerful and really has one in its grip, then by all means just grit your teeth and go off to the cremation ground, and if you can find a corpse, I don't suppose you can in this country, or it is a civilized country and we don't get these sort of spiritual helps. But anyway, you can find something reminiscent of death, if it's even only a skull or a bone or two, or dwell upon the idea of death. I mean, some people familiarize themselves with this idea. Not all, we only laugh because, in a way, we're terrified at bottom. Familiarize themselves with this idea by keeping these things around them. Skulls and bones, after all, what is there to be afraid of? I remember that up at my own place at Highgate, I've got a very beautiful, old, highly polished skull cup. And one day a lady came to tea and was asking about my Tibetan things, and she loved everything Tibetan. So I said to her, "Oh, would you like to see this?" And I put it into her hand and she nearly dropped it, as though it had been a live coal. She said, "Oh, but it's a skull." I said, "Of course it is, the Tibetans are always using them." And Tibetans, I would say, are very fond of these things. They're very fond of anything made out of human bone or a human skull. They're like rosaries made out of bits of human bone. They're like thigh-bone trumpets, and they're like skull cups. And this is only because they take a quite normal, natural, common-sense view about death. They don't think there's anything morbid or anything macabre in it, as we do. We've been brought up in the wrong way. We've been brought up in the Christian tradition in which if you pronounce the word death, it's supposed to send a shiver down your spine. But this isn't the Buddhist way of looking at it. Death is something just as natural, just as normal as life. And I often quote in this connection these very beautiful words of Tagore, the great modern Indian poet, the great Bengali poet Tagore. He says somewhere, he says, "I know I shall love death because I have loved life." He sees them as two facets of the same thing, life and death. If you love life, you will love death. If you can't love death, you haven't really loved life either. It sounds a bit paradoxical, but very deeply true.